This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Thanks for downloading this episode of In Our Time. There's a reading list to go with it on our website, and you can get news about our programmes if you follow us on Twitter at BBC In Our Time. I hope you enjoyed the programmes. Hello, on 16th of July 1945, the first atomic bomb was detonated at Los Alamos, New Mexico. In less than a month, the second and third bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, killing hundreds of thousands of people. This was the outcome of the Manhattan Project, a race by the USA to use a widely known theory about nuclear fission to make a weapon of war before anybody else did. It is a momentous effort, with thousands of scientists, hundreds of thousands of industrial workers, and billions of dollars. Some believe that its use over Japan remains one of the darkest chapters in human history. With me to discuss the Manhattan Project are Bruce Cameron Reed, the Charles A. Dana Professor of Physics Emeritus at Alma College, Michigan, Cynthia Kelly, founder and president of the Atomic Heritage Foundation, and Frank Close, emeritus professor of theoretical physics at the University of Oxford and fellow of Exeter College, Oxford. Frank Close, Frank, what was known about nuclear fission in the late 1930s?
Well, in 1938, the discovery was made that if you use uranium, the atoms of uranium are the heaviest that occur naturally in the periodic table, they're very fragile. And the discovery was that if you just almost touch them with a single neutron, that's a nuclear particle, the uranium was like a drop of water. It would just break apart, split in two. And this action of splitting the uranium has become known as fission. And the process of splitting did two things. One, it liberated a huge amount of energy, huge on the atomic scale, about a billion times larger than one would get in a conventional chemical reaction. But in addition to splitting in two, it liberated a couple of neutrons. So you'd put one neutron in, you'd created some energy and made two more neutrons. So those neutrons are now freed up to hit two more uranium nuclei in your sample and continue the process, making what's become known as a chain reaction with an exponential increase in the energy production. And that was in 1938.
Where was that done, Frank?
That was done in Germany by three scientists in Germany. It was in the open literature. Everybody knew about it. The idea that you could make an explosion, nobody took that seriously at all. But the reason being, to draw an analogy with nowadays, if you think of uranium that you dig out of the ground as being like a group of people and a neutron coming along being like a COVID virus, then there are two types of uranium at work. There's uranium-238, which by analogy is the vaccinated people, and 235 have not been vaccinated. So if you hit the U-235, something happens, but for the 238, nothing happens. So if a neutron hits a U-235, in the modern language, it's got an R value of about 2, and the thing would indeed increase explosively, but for the fact that U-235 is very rare. It's about one in every 140. Most of the uranium that you go on and hit are of the blanketing type, which stop the reaction. So at best, people thought that if you had maybe a ton of uranium after the war, perhaps you might be able to make a heat engine, what we now call a nuclear reactor. But that was about the limit of the ambition.
Who first saw the potential of nuclear fission for making a weapon?
The first people who appear to have asked the question, but suppose that somehow we were given a lump of uranium-235, the stuff that can, in principle, fission and produce energy exponentially. How much would we need to make an explosion? And this question was asked by two Jewish emigres from Nazi Germany working at the University of Birmingham in England. That was Rudolf Piles and Otto Frisch. And what really frightened them was the discovery that if you had a grapefruit size of uranium-235, you could make an explosion that would be equivalent in strength to 1,000 tons of conventional explosive. In addition to that, there would be radiation produced. And they wrote a memorandum. It said that this super bomb, as they called it, would be irresistible because there is no material structure that could resist the force of the explosion, let alone the radiation. Now, what happened at that moment was that having had the idea and the shock of the discovery, you immediately then think maybe scientists in Germany have already had the same idea and come to the same conclusions. Could Hitler already be building such a weapon? And in their memorandum, which they wrote and reached the British government, they said it's conceivable that Germany is in fact developing this weapon, and the only defence against it is to have one yourself. So there in 1940, the beginnings of what we call MAD, you know, mutually assured, whether it's mutually assured destruction or mutually assured defence or deterrence. But they had that insight way back then. And they had this insight in 1940, at the same time the Battle of Britain was raging, the possibility that we had discovered a means of making a bomb that if we got there first could determine the outcome of a war which we looked to be about to lose had a huge amount of impact. And so this project was declared top secret, and the beginnings of the project to try to develop such a weapon was given the code name Tube Alloys, just a name to cover it from anybody.
Thank you. In America, it was taken up. Albert Einstein himself was among those who encouraged the Americans to develop a weapon. How influential was that support and other support? And when did that get going? Cameron?
The letter signed by Einstein that went to President Roosevelt was written in the summer of 1939. And as Frank indicated, it alluded to the possibility of explosives, but it was still very speculative. But the important thing there was that Roosevelt was briefed on that letter in October, and he directed that a research project be initiated by the then Bureau of Standards. And that project became folded into an organization known as the Office of Scientific Research and Development that was coordinating scientific work that might have military application. And that began in 1940 with research on what would be necessary to both build reactors and isolate the uranium-235 that could be used in a bomb. And so the possibility was taken very seriously, and funding began to ramp up in 1940.
Was the American president, was he in favor of it? Did he take notice of Einstein's letter?
Oh, yes. He was briefed on it. As this organization began work on this project, he received regular reports through 1941 in particular, aided by reports as well from Britain that had been stimulated by the Frisch-Pyrles memorandum. And by about 2 weeks before Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt was briefed on the possibilities were now looking more likely and that an expanded program should proceed. And so there's a kind of a popular misconception that not much happened before Pearl Harbor, but things were quite active in both Britain and America.
How quickly can you tell us, and in America, did they proceed towards the great engineering necessary for this? The Brits had brought a lot of theoretical knowledge to the table. They were a bit ahead of the time. But the Americans took on the burden of engineering and building the process plant. Let me put it that way.
That began to advance pretty quickly, of course, after Pearl Harbor, when it was proposed that since there would have to be a huge amount of construction involved, the only some large secretive organization could undertake this. And so in the summer of 1942, the project was transferred to the Army Corps of Engineers, which of course had an enormous budget and could keep this largely secret. So planning for the construction began in 1942 and was seriously getting underway by early 1943.
It went at a terrific pace, didn't it?
It was incredible. I think, you know, any modern project manager would just marvel at what was accomplished in such a short time. And of course, they were under existential threat and had a huge amount of money at their disposal. But it was still a remarkable undertaking in such a short time against all of the other demands of the war.
Cindy Kelly, what do we need to know about General Groves and the difference he made, picking up what Cameron's been saying about the speed of this massive enterprise, employing over 100,000 people, different scientists, different trades and all sorts of things? What do we need to know about General Groves?
Well, as Cameron was saying, the Army Corps of Engineers got the assignment to take charge of this top-secret effort in the summer of 1942. The first person in charge was far too cautious, and the leadership lost patience and looked for someone more dynamic. Well, they found that person in General Leslie R. Groves. He was a dynamo, and many say he was indispensable to the success of the Manhattan Project. He was a West Point graduate. He joined the Army Corps of Engineers right as World War I was ending in 1918 and kind of had various assignments, none of them in war. But in 1940, he had a chance to prove himself. He was a leader in the Army's huge mobilization efforts before the U.S. entered World War II. He directed 1 million men and spent $8 billion constructing camps, air bases, munition plants, hospitals, and even the Pentagon. In the process, he came to know the leading industrial and construction firms, such as Union Carbide, Tennessee Eastman, DuPont, Chrysler, Monsanto, and others who would play a crucial role in the Manhattan Project. He was driven, hardworking, decisive. Most importantly, he was an astute judge of people. J. Robert Oppenheimer, a brilliant physicist at UC Berkeley, was an unlikely choice to direct the scientific research. But Groves ignored the critics. The relationship was a delicate balancing act, but Groves and Oppenheimer made it work and produced the world's first atomic bomb in 27 months.
My goodness. Where were the main sites? They had to find a site for this. Can you tell the listeners where the main site was found? Can we go through that and settle it? Where was it? Where did they decide to build all this stuff, masses of stuff?
Okay. Well, I just want to refer to Danish physicist Niels Bohr's comment, who said, before any of this got started, that building an atomic bomb could never be done without turning the United States into one huge factory. And the Manhattan Project did that. It transformed the United States with hundreds of manufacturers, large and small, in nearly every state. But there were three main top secret sites that were run by the military for the Manhattan Project, where much of the key work was done. The first was a scientific research laboratory in Los Alamos, New Mexico. Here, scientists took over a boys' ranch school. Second was Oak Ridge, Tennessee. This site was dedicated to producing enriched uranium. As Frank explained, you need the U-235 to make an explosion. So they had to try to separate enough of this from the ore in which it occurs naturally. This was the fuel for the bomb used on Hiroshima. The third location was Hanford in eastern Washington state, in the northwest corner of the country. This is where the reactors and other huge facilities were used to produce plutonium. So the huge production facilities at these sites were built and operated by leading U.S. corporations. The Army Corps of Engineers had to reach out to Union Carbide, Tennessee Eastman, for Oak Ridge, the DuPont Company ran the facilities at Hanford. Dozens of other companies built critical parts. Many universities were engaged. I mentioned the University of California, Berkeley, where Oppenheimer was. University of Chicago had 5,000 people working on reactor design, including Enrico Fermi. And Columbia University. To pick up on Niels Bohr's prediction, the nationwide network between the government, U.S. companies, and academia was absolutely essential to the development of the atomic bombs.
We told about 130,000 people one way or another were employed. Frank Close, how much of a driving force was the fear that Germany would get there first?
Well, that was certainly the thing that had frightened Piles and Frisch when they first discovered the possibility of making a bomb. And having discovered the idea, it seemed so obvious that they naturally feared that the Germans were already doing it. I mean, we now know that they weren't, but at that time, that was the driving force. And I think that Groves's mantra was that the project, the mission statement was to get a bomb and be able to deliver it before the enemy can.
As short a mission statement as there's ever been, I should imagine.
Anyway. Yes, and probably one of the most effective.
Let's talk about the difficulty of getting up enriched uranium. How did they go about it when they've got to get a lot now? They set up this industry.
Well, the name of the game was to be able to separate the 235. 235 relative to 238 is a measure of their different masses. And so you had to try to separate these slightly different masses. Today, it's done by using centrifuges. But back in the 1940s, the technology for centrifuges wasn't really that good. And the way that was chosen was the one that Piles started working on in Britain in 1940 with infamous assistant Klaus Fuchs, of whom more later perhaps, was to use diffusion. Uranium in a gas, I think it's uranium hexafluoride gas. The idea was you have the gas in a cylinder, you have a piston at one end and a membrane at the other, and you push on the piston to force the gas through the membrane. And the 235 versions of uranium, being slightly lighter, get through the membrane slightly faster. So on the far side of the membrane, you've got relatively more 235 than 238. So you've now got a new sample which is enriched in 235, to use the jargon. You take that sample, put it in its own piston, repeat the process, and you get an even more enriched. So the sort of questions that they were asking initially in Birmingham and later in the States was how many sequences of enrichment do you have to do? How long does it take? What's the optimum temperature pressure? How big a facility in practice do you need? And by the time the Brits moved all across to North America and the project was set up as the Manhattan Project in America, the initial program that Piles and Fuchs and other Brits were working on in New York was the actual design of the Oak Ridge lab that we've just heard about, where the enrichment took place. And the size of that lab was vast. It was a huge industrial enterprise, as we've already seen. I don't think at the start anybody anticipated. If they'd known at the start what it would have involved, whether it would ever happen is an open question, I think.
One thing that I think that we as Americans forget is that this really was an Anglo effort, not just an American effort, an Anglo-American effort.
Cameron, what about the challenges when handling plutonium, and how did plutonium come into the picture?
To quickly follow up on a point that Frank and Cindy made, I've read that the investment in Los Alamos and Hanford was about equivalent to the automobile industry of the time, to give a sense of the financial scale. Plutonium is a synthetic element. It occurs only in extremely trace amounts naturally, but can be produced by the inert uranium-238 capturing neutrons and then decays to plutonium-239. So the 238 did play a role. And this was the role of the reactors built out in Hanford, Washington, to irradiate natural uranium fuel. And then the advantage of this was that plutonium, being a different element than uranium, once synthesized, it could be extracted by a regular chemical means rather than the complex diffusion apparatus that Frank was just describing. And so Groves left nothing to chance. He invested in both methods. And this was quite remarkable in that, you know, in 1942, there was no discipline of nuclear engineering. This had to be developed from scratch, first with experimental models and then building reactors that operated at power levels of 250 million watts. And this was all built in about 18 months. So the advantage of plutonium is, once synthesized, can be chemically separated, but it proved to be very nasty to work with. It's intrinsically very radioactive. It spontaneously fissions, which put tremendous constraints on the bomb design. It is toxic, like a heavy metal poisoning. And the process was inefficient in the sense that only about one atom in 10,000 gets transmuted in these reactors. So they developed a whole new industry of nuclear engineering and nuclear reactors and the associated chemical processes for separating the plutonium. And that is left, what's left over is very radioactive waste products that are still with us today. But that is the material that was used in the Trinity and Nagasaki bombs.
Thank you. Cindy, what did the people who were working there, these thousands of people suddenly called into work on these massive factories, no expense spared, as big as the automobile industry, what did they think they were working on?
I'd say 95% or more of the participants who were working on the Manhattan Project, the construction workers, the operators of these vast facilities, were not told what they were working on. It was a joke. They were told they were producing toilet paper because...
Really? Toilet paper?
Wow. Toilet paper. One of the children told that to his classmates. He said, I know what they're producing. They're toilet paper. My dad brings home a roll in his lunchbox every day. There were a lot of jokes about what was going on, but this younger Manhattan Project scientists who were recruited by the Army and found themselves in Los Alamos as part of a special engineer detachment that Groves created in 1944 to supplement the senior scientists at Los Alamos. These younger people had studied at least a year or two of science and physics, and they have all told me that they figured it out. They knew that it must be working on a nuclear weapon of some sort. So that's why I say 95% people didn't know, but 5% either knew because they had to because they were actually at Los Alamos working on the bomb itself, or they figured it out.
But in that case, Frank, it must have been very difficult to keep it secret. Groves was determined to keep it secret, top secret. He managed it in a lot of ways, but it leaked one way or another. It was being breached. It was being breached by individuals like Fuchs. Can you talk about him for a moment or two? And around the place. Can you give the listeners some idea of how the real story leaked out?
Well, the first thing was very cleverly in the Soviet Union, something that Groves could not have done anything at all about. A physicist called George Flerov was in the army, and he was on 2 weeks' leave from the front. And he visited the local university to see what had happened in nuclear fission in the previous 2 years. And he looked in the library and discovered two things. First of all, there was not a single paper in the literature that had been published on nuclear fission in 2 years, which was a big shock. And secondly, the likes of Niels Bohr and Fermi and great scientists like that had published nothing themselves. And he put two and two together and realised that they must be operating on a secret project somewhere to develop fission into a weapon, and alerted Stalin to the fact. Actually, Stalin was already aware of this because of spying that had taken place earlier. But that was the first sort of hint that something was going on that you could have done nothing about. Now, you mentioned Klaus Fuchs, and there were other spies. Fuchs somehow evaded vetting. The irony is that he had been a communist in Germany before he left and came over to Britain after escaping Hitler. But the only evidence that MI5 had about this was papers from the Gestapo. And coming from the Gestapo, they just ignored them and disregarded everything. And so Fuchs went through the vetting process, first of all in Britain, and then when he arrived in the States and at Los Alamos. Now, the way that the spying was done was that, and the weakness, if you like, that Fuchs and the other spies had to pass their information to a contact. Fuchs would get out from Los Alamos on a couple of occasions down to Santa Fe, which was about 20 miles away, meet his contact, pass the information to his contact. The contact then passed it on to somebody who took it to the Russian embassy. And then the Russian embassy had to code it up and transmit the information to Moscow. And it turned out that was where the weakness in the whole thing was, because if the coding had been done properly, it would have been totally and utterly uncrackable. The Americans were able to read the messages that were going across, but they had no idea what they said. It wasn't until 1949 that these messages were actually decoded. And that is when we got the first indication that there had been spies at work in Los Alamos, leading to Fuchs's arrest. But by that time, the war had ended 5 years before. So during the war itself, the information was passed across without anybody being aware of it. I should just add one thing. We now know that the only information that was sent went always to the Soviet Union. There was nothing with Germany, there was nothing with Japan or Italy. It was totally driven by political idealism.
Cameron, to those working on the project, how inevitable did success seem going at that speed? Do we have any directives or any comments on them? We're not going to get there, we're getting there. What did they feel about the pace at which they were going, those who knew where they were going?
Of course, they were working at a breakneck pace, and even once these facilities and reactors are running, it takes time to generate this material. And I think once they, you know, I think in a sense, once fission had been discovered, it was inevitable that this would occur, and, you know, obviously the war sped it up, and Groves wanted weapons available in time for use in the war. So this is not to say that they didn't run into problems. The plutonium bomb almost didn't come to fruition because of its spontaneous fission problem. They had to develop an implosive technique to assemble a critical mass. There was a very limited amount of uranium-235 available, so they certainly ran into problems. There was a lot of teething problems in getting these factories going. But by the spring of 1945, both Oak Ridge and Hanford were beginning to produce appreciable amounts of material. Of course, read about the time the war in Europe was ending.
So we're talking about the war in Europe ending, Cindy Kelly. There was a sense in which this was directed against Germany, to stop Hitler. So the war ended in Europe in May 1945. Why did the Manhattan Project not stop then?
Well, the war was being fought in two fronts. It was called a world war for good reason. It was global. The Japanese had started aggressive action in Asia in 1930, invaded China in 1937. While the war was over in Europe, the war in the Pacific was unrelenting. The Japanese were fighting fiercely island to island in the Pacific and held positions on the Chinese mainland and the Philippines. Despite heavy losses of men and material, the military leaders of Japan considered surrender unthinkable. President Truman knew he had an enormously powerful weapon that might shock the Japanese into ending the war. And as with any new promising technology, the military envisioned using it. General Groves worried about testifying before Congress that he spent, in today's terms, upwards of $26 billion, and then decided not to use it. He put tremendous pressure, as Cameron was just saying, on the scientists and technicians at Los Alamos and elsewhere to deliver at least two bombs shortly after the Trinity test on July
16, 1945. At Los Alamos, Frank, can you briefly tell us why that was a warning sign, a proof, what significance it had? This was on 16th of July, 1945, and that could be called the first atom bomb.
It indeed was the first atom bomb. I mean, as has been said in the programme, that there were two routes being followed. The uranium-235, which by that stage was pretty well guaranteed to work. But the plutonium, as Cameron said earlier, was very tricky. And whether that would work or not, nobody was quite sure. So they decided they had to do a test. And that was what the 16th of July Trinity test, as it became known, was. And if one has a moment for the start of the nuclear age, that really was it. And it's very dramatic. I mean, it took place in the New Mexico desert before dawn. The scientists and engineers were bussed away from Los Alamos through the night. It was 2,000 metres or so above sea level there. It was quite cold. The scientists were 20 miles away from where the test explosion was going to take place. And actually, nobody really knew what was going to happen. Groves had prepared three versions for the New Mexico governor. The New Mexico governor was aware that the military were going to do something, but of course he didn't know what the details of it were. But Groves had prepared three statements. One, that the test had been okay. The second level was there had been severe damage. And the third one was obituaries of all present, including himself. So that gives you the range of possibilities that they were anticipating. The actual test itself took place at about 5:30 in the morning before dawn. There was a flash in the sky about 20 miles away, which was described later as being brighter than 1,000 suns. Somebody said it bored right through you and night was turned instantly into day. Some quote I've got down here, like opening heavy curtains of a darkened room to a flood of sunlight. And the heat, that's the thing we don't tend to think about. In addition to the flashes of light, there was heat, and the heat was scorching. It was like an open hot oven with the sun coming out like sunrise. And that is what you saw in an instant when this thing exploded 20 miles away. Now, when you see these things on the TV, what you see is the flash and an instant bang. And of course, it wasn't like that. This was 20 miles away. It took nearly 5 minutes for the sound, the shock wave, to reach the scientists. And the awesome sight that they had seen, and already there was this mushroom cloud developing, they must have been wondering what was going to arrive in 5 minutes when the shockwave came. And what arrived, it was like thunder echoing from the mountains all around, which has continued and continued. And the mushroom cloud continued rising 20,000 feet into the air, changing colour gradually as it did. Gradually, the light level went down, and then the real sunrise took place in the east. This has all taken place in the south. The word awesome is used, but on that occasion, I think it really was. And from the scientist's perspective, it had worked. And I think that is the thing. At that moment, they didn't realise the implications, perhaps, but it had worked. They had controlled and liberated the energy of the atomic nucleus. It was the moment the nuclear age began. It was Promethean in its way. It was a triumph of science and technology.
Thank you. Cameron, to come back to something we alluded to a few moments ago, what calls were there then? To leave it at that, after that first nuclear bomb, let's call it that, were there calls saying, right, we've proved this, we needn't go any further, we can tell people this. Anyway, what calls were there, if any, to leave it at that?
Well, as Cindy indicated a few minutes ago, of course, the war in the Pacific was still going on with incredible ferocity. An invasion of Japan was set for November 1st, and that would have dwarfed the D-Day invasion. The plan was to land about 750,000 troops in the first month or so. And so, the war was still going on in this incredible ferocity. And there was some consideration given to giving the Japanese a demonstration test, but there was fear that, first of all, they had very little fissile material, just enough for a couple bombs at that point. There was concern that if it was a dud, they would lose the element of surprise and it would be a tremendous embarrassment, and perhaps the Japanese would bring prisoners of war into any test area. So it was considered, but by a committee that advised the Secretary of War, but I think it was essentially a foregone conclusion that when the bombs were ready, they would be used and would just come as a tremendous shock to the Japanese.
Cindy Kindekelik, for those who don't know, can you remind us of the effect of the bombs on the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Well, the atomic bombs claimed as many as 140,000 lives at Hiroshima and 74,000 in Nagasaki, and an equal number of people were injured. Major portions of both cities were flattened, leaving only a few concrete and brick skeletons of a few buildings made of those materials. The nuclear radiation released by the fallout from the mushroom cloud that Frank just described, you know, rising 20, 30,000 feet, caused thousands more to suffer from radiation sickness in the weeks, months, and years that followed. Those who survived the bombings are known as Hibakusha. Many of these survivors suffered lifelong psychological trauma. Many are still plagued by anxiety, not knowing when symptoms of radiation sickness may occur. Young women at the time who lived in the two cities were stigmatized and unable to marry for fear of reproductive abnormalities caused by radiation exposure. Even today, survivors live in fear. As Mayor Taui of Nagasaki told me in 2019, their foremost wish is that no one in this world will ever experience what they have gone through. The mayors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki have embraced the mission to convey their wishes to the world and have worked with about 7,000 cities and 170 countries around the world. And as a culmination of their efforts, on January 22, 2021, the United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons went into force.
Frank Close, among the scientists, what were the most significant responses that they had to these bombings?
Well, I'll just say one thing about the scientists. We know these great names today. We view them as like 60, 70-year-old senior citizens. The average age of the scientists building the bomb was about 28. They were like graduate students and new postdocs. Piles, however, who started the whole thing, he wrote eloquently about it later, and he said nobody could feel any pride in having brought this thing about. But this was war, and in war, death, suffering and destruction are unavoidable. And I think that was the reality of it, I think, as Cameron alluded. You know, there were millions potentially going to be killed if the war continued. But with regard to the atomic bomb, Piles also made the following remark, which is, the phenomenon of nuclear fission was discovered and could not be undiscovered.
What was the most, Cameron, what do you think were the most important and earliest lessons from the Manhattan Project?
There are several. I guess one is that, you know, when fission was discovered, it was probably regarded as a pretty arcane academic science experiment. But, you know, sometimes an arcane discovery can have just enormous consequences that nobody can foresee all of them and can really change the world. And that, you know, the project stands as an example of how, kind of a model of how an effort to address an existential threat can be effectively organized and carried out. You need the right advice, getting to the right people, which was one of the problems that was encountered in Germany. You need people who know what they're doing and are trusted to carry out the work. And perhaps there's a lesson here today for COVID and climate change that these enormous projects can be done.
Yes, there's a lot of strange, you know, what-ifs in this story. That's the original calculation of Frisch and Piles that started it all was based upon rather limited knowledge. And we now know that actually they were 10 times more optimistic, if that's the right phrase, than the reality. So if the sums had been correct at the very start and one had realised that to make a uranium bomb would have required 10 times as much as they thought, whether the project would have started at all. Well, of course, we can never know the answers to that, but there's so many things that had to be just in the right place at the right time, or the wrong place at the wrong time, whichever the metaphor in this case is, for it all to have turned out as it did.
Cindy, To come to you towards the end of the programme now, this set off chain reactions, which was part of the nuclear vision, but there's a chain reaction in countries which got the bomb. America disengaged itself from the UK and wanted to go it alone for a while. Churchill then decided we would have our own bomb, we the Brits would have our own bomb. Russia, through one way or another, got the means to make their own bomb, and so it went on around the world. It's sometimes said that it's the politicians who were to blame, as it were, for all this, not the scientists. What do you make of that? Is that a distinction?
I think that's a very apropos distinction, especially when first you look at who influenced the decision to drop the bomb. There were few opportunities for the scientists to influence that decision. Some of them signed a petition to urge Truman to think about what it would be like to have the United States the first nation to drop a bomb, an atomic bomb. It was signed by 153 scientists, but when General Groves got it, he stamped it classified and put it in a safe. Neither Secretary of War Stimson nor President Truman saw it. Leo Szilard quipped that the biggest weapon to emerge from the Manhattan Project was the secret stamp. The senior scientists also were kind of marginalized. They felt, Oppenheimer believed, the decision was essentially a military one that they were not qualified to make. But after the war, they began to question whether scientists should be just dedicated, as Richard Feynman says, to figuring out what goes on and to pursuing how nature works, that they should try to think through the consequences of their discoveries and have some kind of more active role. Of the hundreds of veterans that I've interviewed, hearkening back to Frank's comments, they feel strongly that dropping the bomb was the right thing to do. Others think, no, a well-meaning president made the worst decision. But I think it's a very difficult question. As leading historian of the Manhattan Project, Richard Rhodes predicts, the issue of whether the atomic bombs should have been dropped on Japan and what the right role was for scientists will continue to be debated for decades to come.
Ironically, there was one thing that the scientists did contribute to via the spies, the fact that the Russians got their atomic bomb about 18 months earlier due to the spies than they would have done, meant that in 1950, when the Korean War was starting and some American hawks wanted to drop an atomic bomb over there, they were stopped from doing so because by then we knew the Russians had one themselves. So in a strange sense, Klaus Fuchs and the other spies may have contributed to us being here having this discussion.
Well, it was a terrific discussion. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks to Cindy Kelly, Frank Close and Cameron Reed, and to our studio engineer, Emma Harth. Next week, it's the great Republican experiment in 16th century Europe, the Commonwealth of Poland and Lithuania. Thanks for listening.
And the In Our Time podcast gets some extra time now with a few minutes of bonus material from Melvin and his guests.
Cindy, why don't we start with you?
Okay, as several have mentioned, the work done in Great Britain, the British mission that included Fuchs and Rudolf Peierls and 25 other brilliant scientists who had fled Nazi Germany, were instrumental to the success of the scientists in the United States. In addition, we looked to Canada to get uranium ore. And there's work, valuable work, going on in Montreal and elsewhere. So it really was not just an American do it alone, but it was clearly one of the success stories of the war, an allied effort.
I'll just add into that. I think one of the great ironies is the number of Jewish emigres that Hitler had driven out that then were involved in making this bomb. It wasn't actually used against Germany, of course, but that was one of the great ironies, that Hitler got rid of the very people who might have been able to do it for him.
Exactly.
I'd like to throw in a comment on something Frank mentioned a couple minutes ago about Klaus Fuchs and the Korean War that is what I have come to think of as a sort of theory of nuclear inoculation, that if these things hadn't been used or hadn't been ready in time for the war, and we learned how horrible they were, which is a lesson perhaps people are forgetting now, What might have happened in a later war when there was many more of them, they were more powerful, and we've somehow managed to avoid that fate for the last 75 years.
One of the things I just wanted to add about the reaction to the Trinity test itself, this was a shock that I discovered when I was researching my Trinity book about Trinity and Fuchs and the like. Freedom of Information in the States, we managed to get hold of official copies of lectures that Enrico Fermi gave immediately following the Trinity test and through that autumn. And the shock that I had was that within 3 days of the Trinity test, even before the bombs had actually been dropped over Japan, Fermi had had the insight and gave a lecture that the heat generated by an atomic explosion was hot enough to be the spark to ignite what we now call a hydrogen bomb. And he started giving lectures about the possibilities of making a hydrogen bomb by using the atomic bomb as the spark. And I found that quite disturbing in a way, because that says to me that Fermi was so taken over by the wonder, if that's the right word, I'm looking for a word, but the awe of what had just taken place, the triumph over the atomic nucleus that the scientists had experienced, that the exciting possibilities he'd opened up, without giving a thought to what the end consequence of all this was going to be.
Oppenheimer called it technically sweet.
Yes. They sound horrible now when we look back at this distance. It's easy to be wise after the event. I mean, I suppose I'm glad that I was not 60 years younger, if you like, well, 50 years younger, to have been involved in that, because you feel you would be tainted by it in a way ever after, even though what you did at the time was absolutely necessary.
Cameron and Cindy, what do you think, how do you view the development of the possession of atomic and hydrogen bombs since 1945?
Cindy, do you want to go ahead?
What do I think of the possession?
The development in the possession, yes.
Well, it's become the so-called nuclear club. It's a point of pride. It's more of making sure that your country has the stature alongside of these nations that use their industrial prowess to have this terrible weapon.
You know, in the aftermath of the war, I guess any country that fancied itself as being a world power and had the resources and scientific and engineering capability just felt compelled to develop these things, like Britain and France and Russia and China. And of course, inevitably, the information is going to leak out.
One thing as a Brit on this program, to me, the irony and sadness is that the way we started this program was the discovery of fission, and that people saw it potentially as something post-war, as a way of making a heat engine, what we call a nuclear reactor. And indeed, immediately following the war, Britain took over research in making nuclear reactors and led the world. And as a child, I remember nuclear power was going to be the thing of the future. And sadly, wherever it's being used, Britain is no longer in the lead by a long way. And that's another irony of all this thing. There are some good things that have come out of this along with the bad.
I think another irony is that there's so much political pressure in America to develop the hydrogen bomb. And yet it is so powerful that there's really no credible military mission for it.
Thank you very much indeed.
In Our Time with Melvyn Bragg is produced by Simon Tillotson.
What's the link between poisoned underpants?
They wanted something that rubs against your skin.
A plot to kill Nelson Mandela.
To find a poison that would cause cancer and have him die shortly afterwards.
And the deadly riots in South Africa this year. I'm Andrew Harding with A Tale of Politics and Paranoia.
Some people wanted me dead.
Oh, and the link is Jacob Zuma, South Africa's former president.
And indeed, it was quite a strong poison.
That's Poison from BBC Radio 4. To listen to all 5 episodes, just search for Seriously on BBC Sounds.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.